Kia ora, I'm Graham. Welcome to episode 11 of The Good Oil, Conversations with Aotearoa Painters. In this episode, I visit Ari Hallendorn in his home and studio in Lower Hutt, Wellington. Ari holds a Bachelor of Fine Arts from Massey University. He has exhibited in galleries in Australia and New Zealand for over 15 years and has held in several public and private collections, including the Chris Parkin Collection and the Wellington City Council Collection. He is represented by Sweet Gallery in Wellington and Auckland. In this episode, you'll hear Ari talk about how he came to his hybrid approach that mixes representation, abstraction, and portraiture, his interest in the microscopic and human anatomy informing his practice, the careful optical considerations of colour and colour mixing to create the effects he wants, the diverse range of unlikely tools he uses for applying paint, and sourcing his favourite brushes by stealing them from his daughter's watercolour set. We started by talking about his first experiences of painting.
Yeah, it was a funny thing because when I was a young kid, I did a lot of model making, making aeroplanes and painting miniature figurines, mostly Warhammer figurines when I was quite young. And we did that with a friend of mine and my friend Nick. And we did that for a number of years, but after a while I got a little bit bored of just painting little figures. There was rules to follow, and I guess I wanted to break away from that a little bit. And my friend Nick's mum was a hobby kind of painter in a little cupboard in the hallway. So I had all these model paints, and she suggested I try making a painting. So she gave me a little canvas board, and I just sort of didn't know what to do because this was before I had any sort of formal art training, and thought I'd just throw the paint at this canvas and dripped it a little bit and sort of made this kind of splatter type painting. And
you were 6, 7, 8, or 8?
Oh, no, this was probably when I was about 12 years old.
Okay, right.
Yeah, and it was a really interesting process because I didn't know what I was doing, but I was trying to make something, but I didn't know really what I was trying to make. And I think I tried to paint a boat or something, but it didn't work out, so I just ended up dripping this paint.
And so it ended up being abstract rather than...
Pretty much.
Right,
And I found that quite intriguing because I'd sort of broken the rules of what I was used to doing, and it was really difficult and muddy and unknown.
So you mean you didn't have a clear process to follow? You're confronted with a blank canvas as a 12-year-old?
Yeah, yeah. And it was a really cool sort of thing. And I guess I've been trying to discover what I want to make with painting ever since then, you know.
So that is almost a defining moment, 12-year-old Ari, and that first experience of blank canvas and what do I do with this?
Yeah, that was the sort of point in which I started making art, basically. But it wasn't for a few years after that until I sort of revisited that, because that was sort of a one-off event. And then I just went back into a schooling environment. You know, you do third form art and you make masks and you do paintings, and then fifth form art, we studied Picasso and Braque and did cubism and fracturing of the human body and things like that. So, and that was really interesting too, because that really opened my mind to the idea of not just representation, but pulling things apart and then gluing them back together and creating composite paintings.
To go to high school, to jump forward into high school,
yeah,
you ended up with Rob McLeod as an art teacher.
That wasn't until I moved to Wellington High School. I originally started at Wellington College, and there were some good art teachers there too. And that's where I did School C Art. It wasn't until I was about 15 that I moved to Wellington High School, and then I met Rob McLeod.
Because obviously, you know, Rob McLeod's an extraordinary, I suppose, high school art teacher to end up having. Just dumb luck that you ended up with Rob McLeod, or was it by design?
Well, when I was at Wellington College, I had a friend, my friend Nick, who I grew up with. He went to Wellington High School, and through him I met a lot of people that I played music with. And but Sam Morrison, his son, I met, and I started going to Sam's house a little bit and met Rob through that.
Oh, so you knew Rob before you ended up at high school, so not quite
very
dumb luck.
Very briefly. No, yeah, but then all my friends ended up being at Wellington High School, and so I just thought I'll just go there. And basically Rob was my art teacher. But I didn't do painting at Wellington High School, funny enough. I did sculpture.
Huh.
And so he was my sculpture teacher.
Right, but nevertheless influential in many ways,
yeah,
I assume.
Because I was visiting his house regularly.
Right, and seeing his work.
Yeah, up in his studio. And he was doing sort of anthropomorphic, abstract, figurative, drippy stuff at that time.
Yeah, and I mean, to think about Rob McLeod and your work, you know, they're not necessarily 100 miles apart, right?
I definitely have some strong influence from him,
yeah.
I think. I've sort of moved away from a direct influence from him a long time ago. But yeah, I think so, because he was sort of the first real artist that I met. I mean, he made some incredible works over the years.
Okay, so from high school then, you decided by the end of high school or even maybe before then that you wanted to, you know, continue a greater commitment to the art practice?
Well, at the time I was also a really keen musician.
Mm.
So I was playing the bass guitar quite a lot with a band and kind of doing both at the same time, painting, playing music. And I wasn't really sure what I was doing with it because when I left high school, I didn't really think of it potentially being a job or something that I could do full time. When I left high school, my parents suggested I tried doing a hairdressing apprenticeship because it's a creative field, I guess.
And, right.
And so I did that
because,
for a while.
Because being an artist wasn't a realistic career.
Oh, well, not for me at the time, no.
Yeah.
So I did that for a year, but it didn't really pan out. It wasn't really my thing. So after about a year of doing that full time, I decided that I actually wanted to be an artist full time, but I didn't know how to go about doing that. So I just stopped doing that and did part-time work, working in cafes.
And this is when you were sort of late teens?
18, yeah.
And at some point then obviously started thinking about, you know, university and Massey specifically? Or?
That wasn't for a few years after that. So when I was about 18, I started looking for a cafe job and I ended up just walking into a bunch of cafes and asking if they had work. And fortunately enough, I ended up in a cafe on the terrace called Cafe Mode, and the owners of that cafe were artists as well. And they gave me a job, and that was really great because I just worked part-time and then I'd paint after work. And also Julian, the owner, he mounted my first few exhibitions as well.
Oh, in the cafe space?
Yeah. So that was like a gallery cafe. And it was really great because it allowed me to test some really early sort of exhibitions. And I think I did about 5 or 6 exhibitions with that at that cafe.
Wow,
in
so,
the 1990s.
So this is while you were still like 18, early 20s.
Yeah, 18 to 20 or something like that. And they were really encouraging for me to test out works, you know.
And literally then be in the cafe quietly making coffee, observing people's reaction to your work?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I remember I made one painting, a self-portrait of myself making coffee. It was a frantic painting. There was drips everywhere. It was unresolved. It was really sketchy. And someone came in and said, oh, wow, you must really like Basquiat's work. And I was like, I don't know who Basquiat is, you know. And they said, oh, you should check his work out. And then I did. And I was like, oh, my God, I just basically replicated a Basquiat painting without even knowing it. You know, got the example there in the book.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, wow, I should really look at this guy. And I've always really liked his work since I've made those paintings.
Since someone pointed out the similarity.
Yeah, I was drinking a lot of coffee then and probably a lot of nervous energy when I was a teenager, you know. That's around the time I met David, actually, my art dealer, David Allsop.
Yeah, so represented by, I just dropped this in here, represented by a Sweet Gallery in Wellington.
In Wellington and Auckland as well. Yeah,
yes.
This is well before he had a gallery, probably about 10 years before he had a gallery at least. You
right,
know?
Because Davidson's worked as a lawyer, so I'm not sure if he
That's
was still...
That's right.
Right, so he was in the neighbourhood.
Yeah, he was. He worked on the terrace, and but he, I think he was collecting art then too, and had a keen eye for art anyway, and he used to see my work a lot then, and so he knows my work from way back. And
so he was quietly watching a progression, you know, of what was ending up on the cafe walls.
Yeah, And then, I mean, every exhibition was probably quite different. I went through a lot of changes in my practice in those years. Probably every exhibition, there was a significant shift in my work. I guess because I was learning about painting and and adopting influences and testing things out.
And this is all before you ended up all committed to going to Massey.
That's right. Yeah, so at that time, as I said, I was playing a lot of music and playing with a band. And so I was actually studying to go to jazz school, studying the bass. I was playing a lot of bass guitar, and I think I got to the age of about 20, and I had to sort of, all my friends were going to Auckland, and I was like, oh, what do I do? I don't know if I want to go to Auckland. I sort of wanted to paint and do my own thing and travel a little bit. So I sort of came to a point where I thought, can I do both professionally, or can I just do one at the moment? And I thought, well, I want to travel, so I decided to break away and go to Europe instead. And so I spent quite a bit of time over there traveling around, reflecting on my art practice, and yeah, decided to just go with that.
That process then of traveling through Europe, presumably time in galleries, like that experience, that was like a key experience of driving you back to, or getting you to commit yourself to the practice.
Yeah, I saw some key exhibitions over there that sort of opened my idea to painting as a practice. And like, I saw a really great Mondrian exhibition in the Netherlands, and it sort of had every work that he ever made.
Wow.
Well, a lot of them, from really early tree paintings and landscapes, and the slow progression he took to his abstract stuff that he's known for now, his, you know, primary colour squares and stuff like that. And it really showed me, it's amazing to see them all together, because he'd just progressively worked towards abstraction. Yeah. I didn't realise that, because when you see Mondrian, you just mostly see his later stuff. And then also what you see, what you don't in the books as well, is the handmade quality of them. You see pencil marks, you see the hand of the artist, and it really intrigued me.
Yeah, I've actually heard Judy Miller say just the same. Like, when she first encountered those Mondrian paintings in person, she was, I think she said she was shocked at just how handmade they are.
Mm. And also not necessarily, it's also the scale of things too. You think of these masterpieces as ginormous things, but when you go to see them, they're usually only about this, you know, the domestic size paintings. You know, I saw an incredible exhibition of Frida Kahlo in Italy as well, and I was just blown away by how small they were, but how beautiful and incredibly intriguing they were as objects and as ideas, I guess.
The experience of those important paintings, like Frida Kahlo, Mondrian, just continued to reinforce the idea with you that, that painting was something you wanted to pursue.
Definitely. Mm. And also people like Salvador Dali, I went to visit his museum there, and I tried to see as much art as possible while I was over there.
Mm.
Picasso and Spain and things like that. So it was an incredibly enriching experience.
And so that's the piece that then drove you back to, like, returning to New Zealand and committing to a degree, like some formal training.
I didn't, not for a few years after that, actually. I came back to New Zealand, and I was in this weird space where I wanted to make art full-time again, but I wasn't ready to come back to New Zealand, so I came back for about 6 months and then went to Australia for a while and lived in Melbourne and managed to find this house in the suburbs, which was a condemned house that was ready to be demolished, and it was really cheap to live there, so I managed to rent a bedroom and a studio for about $25 a week. And so that gave me the financial freedom to not have to work a full-time job.
And started, so really committing to painting on an almost daily basis?
I mean, I set it up so I worked in the weekends in a cafe, and I had Monday to Friday to paint.
Wow,
and
great.
It was probably the first time that I sat down and actually had a whole week to just explore my ideas and read books. And I didn't have a computer or anything like that, so this was pre, you know, smartphones, and I didn't have the internet or anything, so I just had books. And so throughout that year, I just made art, and nothing, I don't think anything survived that year. I haven't kept anything from there. I gave a lot of it away to my flatmates when I left. A lot of it ended up in the rubbish bin. But it was just a great time to explore what I wanted to do. But then I still didn't know a way of developing a professional art practice in terms of how do I create a sustainable practice long term. But my flatmate, who was a high school teacher, you know, talked to me a lot about the idea of possibly going to university, and I should consider that as an option, which I hadn't at that time.
Had you just not made the connection between, you know, that level of commitment in terms of tertiary study and painting, or...?
No, I think it's just that I didn't have university entrance. I didn't get that qualification, so I didn't really consider it as an option at that time.
Huh.
But then I was coming up to 2002, 2003, and I was like, oh, I can go to university, because when I turned 23, I didn't need to have that university entrance. I could be a mature student. So I thought, okay, maybe I can do this. And then I thought university would be a really good way of creating a critical eye for my own practice and being able to discuss my practice with other people in that sort of environment would be really helpful.
So that was then, so you returned from Melbourne back to Wellington?
I did, yeah. I came back to Wellington to go to university.
Right.
So I quickly put together a portfolio of stuff that I'd developed over the years, some drawings, and I think I went to some life drawing classes down in Wellington just to develop some drawings and put together the portfolio and submitted the portfolio and started in 2003 at the second half of the year because I wanted to start, so picked up some part-time papers, which was turned out to be really good because it allowed me to do a double major, because I started my painting before the degree. Painting papers. So I finished it earlier, which then allowed me to do the sculpture as well. So I did a double major of painting and sculpture.
You hadn't necessarily settled on painting as a preferred discipline, I suppose.
No, I did actually. By that stage, it was definitely painting.
Ah, okay.
But university allowed me to explore everything at the same time.
Hmm.
So I did sculpture, I did... installation, performance, and I incorporated music within the performance and music within installation practice.
But all with an idea that would feed into paintings?
No, I did them for their own purpose. But I've always loved painting, I think. I think because of the influence of Rob McLeod and... But also there's other people as well, you know, my friend Victor Berezovsky. I'm going back now again to when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
I met a guy called Victor when I was about 15 as well, after he finished art school and moved to Wellington. And he knew Rob McLeod too through Wellington High School.
Right, so. Nature of New Zealand, relatively small community.
Yeah. Well, Rob did teach at Wellington High School for 30 years full time. So there was a lot of people that went through Wellington High, you know.
Mm. And then those key teachers at Massey, so I know like Simon Morris was one,
yep,
right?
He was my painting lecturer, and so was Karen von Roosmalen and Richard Redaway. He was my critical studies lecturer, I guess, not critical studies, contextual studio teacher. Massey's statement is context is everything. And it's so true, you know, I love that. Nothing is bad, it's just potentially in the wrong context. The right context can activate something or elevate something and give it meaning or take meaning away.
And that being a central to their teaching.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So they don't teach painting as a discipline there. It's the contextualizing painting within art. And I think that allowed me to explore a whole lot of different mediums and different things, you know. I really enjoyed going to Massey. I thought those 4 years or 4.5 years that I was there allowed me just to make art and explore drawing, and I don't think I really finished or resolved anything there. I think I just developed ideas.
What was leaving university like, or, you know, like, because I hear some artists talk about how challenging it is to move from that relatively, I suppose, safe environment, you know, supported by lecturers, et cetera, out into quote unquote real world.
Mm-hmm.
Are you challenged for you or not?
It wasn't too bad because I'd made art on my own independently for a number of years before I went to university. It wasn't too bad for me because I kind of knew what to expect when I left university. And also in my last year at university, I was starting to show in artist-run spaces as well.
Mm.
And also I was curating exhibitions of people that I went to university with and putting on exhibitions throughout the university. So in my term breaks, I was curating exhibitions, finding exhibition spaces, and putting on shows.
Right, so you were pretty close to what life would be like outside of university anyway.
That's right. And in my last year, I booked in a number of shows for the following year, so I had things to get on with.
I'm just trying to close the gap between 2011, first show at Sweet.
No, 2007.
2007.
So directly after university. So, yeah, just in my final year, David came back from Europe and he was starting the gallery and he was looking for artists to represent. And
so despite a presumably what sounds like about a five-year gap from you, you know, working at a cafe and David first seeing your work to then inviting you to show at Sweet.
That's right, yeah. And so basically what happened was that Julian, the guy who ran the cafe, was in conversation with David and suggested that he visit my studio at university. And so he came over and I had just everything there. It was tons of work. And he thought, yeah, we can possibly work together. So straight out after university finished, I did my first exhibition with David.
Right, so that actually sounds like it was a pretty straightforward transition. I was going to ask if it was, you know, nerve-wracking or, you know, a challenge, but it doesn't sound like it was.
Well, I had the work already.
Yeah.
And because I'd known David from those years back, it was sort of a really easy kind of relationship to start, you know, and he's always been a really easy person to work with.
Yeah, having the right dealer makes a big difference, right?
Yeah, he kind of trusts in what I do in the studio and I trust in what he does in the gallery.
Yeah.
And, so it basically started like that. And, yeah, so after university, I just basically started making art full-time. I did go to overseas after university as well. I went to Asia, I went to South Korea and taught English. But ultimately, we didn't stay there because there just wasn't an opportunity for me to engage with the art culture there. Because we lived on an island, going to the mainland was really difficult and there wasn't any galleries where we lived. So we decided to come back to New Zealand and focus on establishing ourselves here in New Zealand. When we came back here, we moved to Auckland for a number of years and I went to Teachers College in 2010. With the idea that I was going to become an art teacher.
Huh.
But that, in high schools, but I didn't work out. I ended up getting a job in a disability art studio up in Auckland called Spark Studio.
Yeah.
And that was in Morningside. And that was really good. And
Good to, again, inform the practice or good just the day-to-day different experience?
It was the best day job that I've ever had because it was a studio environment. I was working with artists in a studio environment, so I was able to work alongside people in a related subject that I was interested in. And also I was curating exhibitions for people with disabilities, and that was really fun, you know. I got an opportunity to talk with a whole lot of different people about art. I did that for a number of years.
All day, every day.
Yeah, that's right. So I'd do that part-time during the day, then I'd paint in the afternoons and mornings and weekends, and yeah, that was great. That was a really good time. Did that for about 3 years.
And then moved back to Wellington.
We did, for family reasons.
Yeah.
And at that time, I was looking to get that similar sort of work in Wellington, but I decided to sort of take a leap of faith and just paint full-time.
Well, and by then you must have been two or three shows deep into shows at Sweet, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think we moved back to Wellington about 9 years ago, about 2013, and I was showing with Sullivan and Strumpf as well and with David, so I was doing two solo shows a year at the time.
Just as a reference point for listeners, Sullivan and Strumpf, a Melbourne-based gallery, right?
Sydney.
Sydney-based gallery.
Yeah. And came back to Wellington and put together a show for David to take to the Melbourne Art Fair. And at that time, I thought my painting was getting a lot more detailed and was starting to take a lot longer, and I just wanted to spend more time doing that as opposed to the distraction of a day job.
Keen to talk about that evolution of style, especially from those first few shows at Sweet. And it's interesting, we'll probably jump around a little bit here and both, you know, approach and process. But those first few shows at Sweet seemed, you know, really heavily figurative. And you talked about a first work being a self-portrait in the cafe.
Yeah.
So it seems like the first work was really informed by portraiture.
Yeah, well, I've always been interested in the genre of portraiture and photography. When I was a teenager, I used to do a lot of photography, take pictures of my friends, and had a dark room in my parents' basement. Spent my teenage years printing out pictures, and I always really liked the human face and the expressions, and so that always has informed my interest in the subject matter. Also, the people that I've always been interested in have been figurative painters, Francis Bacon, Rob McLeod, Basquiat, Picasso, but they've also had aspects of abstraction and fragmentation within their practice, I guess. Since the invention of cameras, artists haven't had to solely represent the human body in a realistic form. They've been able to do it in different ways. So
yeah, it's
always
funny,
kind of
it,
intrigued me.
Yeah, there's some irony there that the introduction of photography has actually given greater license to painters.
That's right. It freed up painters to not just be studio portrait painters or representation of the world around them as it's seen, you know, or a curated form of the things that are around them, you know. So that's always been really interesting to me.
Yeah, and because it seemed like, again, looking at those shows from 2007 through to, say, 2011, 2012, it's Sweet. Now, again, appreciate this, you know, a lot of work, obviously, you've described this morning backing that up. But yeah, it seemed like you moved really, really quickly being 2 or 3 years from what was clearly figurative portraiture work into that, you know, more abstracted work. And wanted to ask here, this is probably as theoretical as we'll get maybe in this conversation, but I look at the history of pointillism and your work, and it seems like a real, you know, reference to or riff on pointillism. Is that fair, or do you see that similarity, or is it conscious?
Yeah, definitely. I've always really enjoyed looking at European impressionism and pointillist painting. That sort of period of painting is really interesting because that was cutting edge at the time. Looking what we know now, you wouldn't think of it, but there were breaking boundaries back in those days. Even Van Gogh, you know, I mean, that sort of really busy handmade quality of a painting, I quite like that. I think that's a really interesting area of painting.
Yeah, which seems to also then go into that piece for you of wanting to play with, I suppose, are you comfortable with the words psychedelic and, if not, kaleidoscopic being applied to your work?
Yeah, well, I've always been interested in the microscopic. If you know, if you look under anything under a microscope, there's lots going on, you know, and it's busy and it's fascinating, and it's I like the word fantastical, you know, and yeah, but psychedelic, I guess, definitely.
Jump back to high school, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about this more, but those elements of almost, you know, biological or cellular that's present in your work seems like it's absolutely seen through a microscope. So was, you know, science informed that as well?
Oh, definitely. We dissected mice and things like that. And I think my science teacher brought in a human lung, or not a human lung, like a animal lung once, and hooked it up to a vacuum cleaner to, you know, blow it up and show us the workings of lungs. And yeah, I've always been interested in the human anatomy and the human body and the functions of it. And the reason why I started using human anatomy in my paintings was I was looking for a model, a way of creating an open form for me to play with paint within. And before I was doing the human anatomy, I did these sort of series of uncanny paintings of human portraits with sort of tentacles coming out of their heads. I've always been interested in the idea of the uncanny, that sort of uneasy feeling of a familiar object in unfamiliar contexts. And I guess a lot of my influences, like Francis Bacon would be a key influence in that sort of area, where he creates sort of familiar faces or parts of faces in these familiar sort of environments, but they're so unusual and kind of horrific, you know, but so familiar at the same time.
And yeah, so back to what you're saying before about massing and teaching, context is everything.
Yeah, and this sort of, you don't know what exactly what's quite happening in these sort of paintings, but they're intriguing, you know. So I created these uncanny paintings of these portraits with tentacles, and the tentacles just came out of me pushing watercolour paint around on a piece of paper and with a straw, and I thought, wow, if I put that with a portrait, what does that make and what does that mean? I'm not quite sure, but let's just put it together and see if we can make something interesting from it.
That period seems, period, I'm talking about 2007 to 2014, maybe quite a long time, but seemed like you were playing around. Like, I think of looking back at work from that, probably actually 2009 to 2012, thereabouts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You seem to be playing with both that pointillism riff and then also there's elements of mosaic sitting side by side.
Definitely. I was doing abstract paintings and figurative paintings, and I was it was quite a difficult thing to do at the same time, and after a while I just started to just merge them together.
It just was easier to bring them together.
Definitely. Yeah, I think so. I think, again, it came to a point where, am I going to be an abstract painter or am I going to be a figurative painter? And I felt a little bit uneasy about being either or. So I thought, with the influence of people like Picasso and Cubism, I thought, well, why not just bring them together? And
right, so they gave you the permission to mash them together and see where it went.
I think so, yeah.
The other piece around evolution of work into that space, so the portraiture, you know, leading into the abstraction, is it purely a byproduct that work being, you know, ends up being really textual,
or by design? By design. I mean, I like texture, and I like the illusion, the optical illusion. That sort of, I like activated spaces, and I like activated surfaces. So, I like that. When people look at my work, they come into it and there's a tactile quality to it. It's textural, it's moving visually. I think that's really important for my work.
How conscious are you of the experience the viewer is going to have when you're putting a work together, like from composition right through to execution of work? Are you thinking about the viewer, you know, right from the start or not, or something in between?
Probably, yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm probably more concerned about what other painters think of my work than I think painters paint sometimes for other painters, you know?
Yeah, right. So are you a painter's painter?
Probably, yeah. I always think, what would Rob think of this painting, or what would my friend Matt Hunt think of this painting?
Oh, the public be damned.
Because they know so much about painting and the history of painting.
Yeah.
And they probably know so much about my paintings that they think of them in those terms, you know?
Yeah.
Deconstruct them.
Yeah. Right, going back to that texture piece, that texture piece is really important.
I think so, yeah. My paintings are a lot flatter now that I'm doing acrylic paintings, but I'm bringing texture in them again through the optical illusion, pairing up opposing colours and things like that. So,
optical illusion absolutely by design, and is that born out of purely colour matching as opposed to composition?
Yeah, it's definitely by design. I test things out. I sort of make some decisions and follow a process and just lay things down. And sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. And sometimes you don't know. Because I don't design things on a computer, I don't know if they're going to work until I've done them, tested things out, so.
What does that design process look like, or what does that process look like?
Well, I usually start with a very basic, a platform, and at the moment I'm doing these interiors, so I just start with a basic room, and that, in a way, sets the stage. My friend Victor always says, setting the stage, you know. I thought, yeah, maybe I should just try that out, and okay. So if I do that, have the environment to start with, And then I can employ all my different subject matter within that, not necessarily thinking about how things fit in terms of a logical way, but
from a structural point of view, in terms of structure, in terms of composition.
Yeah, I would say I'm a kind of a formalist painter, in that I'm really interested in the arrangement of things and the pairing of things and the way things sit side by side and how colour can react or activate things within a painting, as opposed to having a clear narrative that I'm trying to discuss within a work. I kind of work with things that I'm interested in and then put them in a painting and see how they work. It's a weird zone to sit within, because I imagine some people would have a very clear idea of what they're trying to convey within a painting, but I'm kind of interested in the idea of an open-ended painting. And what I think is that when someone comes to my painting and looks at it, they're not necessarily going to take my reading of a painting, they're going to read it in their terms.
So nothing too pre-prescribed in terms of what their viewer experience is going to be. Maybe from a, I don't know, narrative point of view, but you do want to, I don't know, mess almost with experience from that, you know, contrast of colour, kaleidoscopic or psychedelic experience.
But I also understand that the context of a work, whether it's time, whether it's a place, is going to change the reading of a work and potentially the meaning of a work. So there's no point in trying to over articulate for me in a painting, or try to direct a person to a particular meaning.
Which probably brings us back to starting point of composition. You work from found images, right? Or from mm-hmm. images.
Yeah.
I suppose how found are they? Like, you have a good, you know, I guess a mental reference point of what images you want to use, or is that process relatively random?
Well, at the moment I've been collecting magazines and books and taking out images that I think would potentially represent ideas that I'm interested in. And as a starting point, yeah. So I've been cutting out things and making collages, and then sometimes directly putting the collage in my paintings. But anything goes, really.
Well, when you say collage into paintings, you mean transferring an experiment of a collage into paint onto the canvas?
Yeah, directly putting collages in the paintings as well, you know, as a way of visually seeing what I'm going to work with. But I see every painting as a proposal, as a potential idea. I don't see everything. Finished paintings are proposals.
There is a relatively open idea of where any particular work is going to end up. You're not sure where it's going to end up when you start.
No, and I'm making decisions right to the final brushstroke, and I allow things to come into the work, and even if it never ends up staying in there. Yeah, I don't have a fixed idea of what I'm painting, because I draw as I go. And I kind of like that zone, because it's an unknown. It's unknown and it's challenging.
When do you know a painting is finished?
Well, that's a tricky one. I guess it comes down to feeling, I guess, at the end of the day. And sometimes I will stop working on a painting and I might put it away for 6 months, thinking that I'm going to come back to finish it, and then I look at it again and I feel like I don't need to work on it anymore.
Right, that's interesting. So the importance of disconnecting yourself for a while from a work.
Time can do funny things in that respect. I think the reason why I don't plan my work too much is because the time in which it would take for me to plan a work would be the same amount of time as it would take to make a painting.
Right.
And then I'd be making the work twice. I'm just illustrating the painting, or am I developing a painting, you know?
Right, so you find a better process basically to develop it on the canvas as you go.
Yeah, it's a process, you know, and it's a bit like life, you know. You can't plan everything out in life, and so it's a bit like a living work. So they reflect a period of time.
Yeah.
And we might not know for 100 years whether what they mean, but maybe when you look back on them, you might be able to contextualize them within this time. Because
yes.
they incorporate images from now, from around me, the domestic environment, the landscape, you know.
So obviously the practice is constantly evolving, and there seems to be in the last two or three years, there's been quite a shift back to really figurative work. So again, looking around the studio at the work at the moment, there is clearly, you know, figures, birds, landscape is really present, furniture, you know, far more figurative work than there was just in that abstracted portraiture from 4 or 5 years ago. So why moving back to that?
I think my life prior to having kids was a lot more chaotic, and so the work was a lot more chaotic and busy. I was all over the place. And now that I've got kids, I'm at home a lot more. I work from home. I'm a bit more settled. And I needed to, I guess, organize the work a little bit more. And I guess articulate the spaces within the sort of pictorial space, the four walls of the canvas. And I'm enjoying that space at the moment because I'm able to separate things, and it's a much easier way of organising the spatial elements of the work.
So are they a reflection of feeling a little more settled? Like they are almost...
Definitely a lot more mature.
Yeah, because they look almost... Some of them are domestic scenes, right? The ones with furniture and...
Yeah, but they're make-believe spaces. They're not my house. They're just... I mean, I find images from magazines, because magazines are great because they're like professional photographers taking pictures of nice houses and stuff, and all the compositions are beautiful, and so I can just take the ones that I like the look of and pull things apart. But yeah, every day the domestic environment is, I'm around it a lot more, so I guess it's reflective of where I'm at in life.
So does that include, like, we're looking at a work that's sitting, you know, behind you that is certainly a domestic scene, so very figurative furniture, but there appears to be an Ari Callendorn painting on the wall of that room.
Yeah, paintings within paintings.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a cool idea because, in a way, I can paint anything I want within that painting. It can be I was thinking it could be an earlier work, it could be a work that I could create in the future. And what sort of time does that sit within? And it sort of allows me to create an openness within the painting.
It seems quite playful to include, as I say, a portrait of your own within a painting of your own.
Yeah, and I can make an object anything I want as well, because there's a floor lamp sitting there, but it's a planet. You know, it could be the sun, or it could be a moon or something like that. And yeah, there's a bit of cultural reference in there too. There's an object.
A Dutch windmill.
A vase sitting on the tabletop with a Dutch windmill, which is new to me, introducing a bit of a cultural sort of aspect in the work.
That's funny that it's new to you. I mean, obviously, as discussed, six-year-old Ari arrives from the Netherlands to New Zealand, but it's, 30-plus years, shall we say, until a Dutch cultural reference directly ends up in a painting?
Yeah, I guess when I moved here, you just sort of assimilate into the New Zealand culture and get on with life, right, at that age. You don't really think about it too much. And now I'm starting to think, I think since I've been inheriting stuff from uncles and stuff from the Netherlands and older stuff that relate to my history, I think maybe I should start examining that aspect of my life a bit more in the work.
Right, so the Netherlands is slowly bleeding back into your life and therefore into work.
Mm. And because, you know, everything's all meshed together. The paintings are composite paintings as well, so they have ideas related to human anatomy, the domestic environment, the future, ideas around space, humanity, climate change. It's all there.
Yeah.
And I kind of like the idea of this melting pot of everything, the whole world encapsulated in one artwork.
So them being those imagined spaces, putting all of that together.
Yeah.
So we may see more Dutch reference as more paintings evolve.
I think so.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and it could change again, you know. Maybe I'll get too self-conscious of that and maybe I'll take it out. I don't know. But at the moment I've put it in there. I kind of test every idea that comes to mind because you never know until you do it whether it's going to work or not.
Your work seems so experimental. So something I'm curious about is what the attrition rate is. What works and what doesn't? Are there works you need to abandon? Like you were showing me, and this is, again, for listener reference, whoever gets to see this show in around August 2023, almost every one of these canvases has older work on the back of them, which seems like a terrific bonus to anyone that's, you know, thinking about acquiring work.
Yeah. I mean, in the past, I would have made lots more quantity of paintings and a lot of them would have been overpainted or destroyed. But now I would spend at least a year with a whole lot of paintings at the same time. So I tend to start, it's a revolving studio. So when I finish something, I start something new. So I usually have about 15 or 16 paintings on the go at all times.
And adding to them on you might work on one for a day, or are you working on multiple paintings within a day?
Yeah, I usually have a primary painting that I'm working on that particular day and a secondary one for leftover paint. And then usually I'll focus on one painting and until I get stuck or I've finished what I intended to do. And the secondary painting is for leftover paint, little scuff marks or bits of detail. And then, I mean, it changes all the time, whatever I feel like, really.
Brings me to asking you about how you structure your day. So it sounds like you really treat it like a day job, right? You're 9 to 5 or?
I come in here in the morning and I just paint all day. Yeah, it's a day job, I guess, but with the freedom that I just make what I want.
Mm.
And if I find something difficult and I don't feel like working on it, I don't. I just grab something else. But saying that, I do try to tackle the most difficult things first because then the easy stuff's fun, you know?
Yeah, right.
You just do easy stuff first, then the difficult stuff becomes problematic and you start procrastinating on it. So I do try to tackle the most difficult thing. And at the moment, it's definitely... I try to focus on the images within the painting and then everything else sort of slots into place, you know.
How much is problem solving in the work?
Most of it, yeah. The sort of patterns and the decorative stuff, it should come after the really difficult stuff's organised, you know.
So the really difficult stuff being composition?
Composition and the images which I'm trying to paint within the work. And that will then define what I'm doing around it.
And those images seem to be coming to the fore. So again, looking at this work that will be in the public space in 2023, as I said, far more figurative than abstract. Why is that figurative work become so much more present?
I guess I'm wanting to articulate some ideas more than in the past where I was trying to distort my ideas. I was, I spent quite a bit of time being quite self-conscious about defining myself as an artist or trying not to pigeonhole myself, paint myself into a corner.
No pun intended.
Yeah. And now that I've got sort of more of an open format for my painting, which is this kind of domestic environment or the stage, you would say, I can articulate ideas a bit more clearly. And because they're not singular paintings, I feel like there's... room to discuss a whole lot of different things within one idea.
There are a lot of birds appearing in new work.
Yeah, well, the birds are beautiful, you know. And we get a lot of native birds in our garden, and I wanted to incorporate that. And they've become abstract shapes the way I paint them too. Well, there's a lot of history of people painting birds in New Zealand. Bill Hammond would be a great example. I've wanted to incorporate some sort of animal in my paintings. Last year I did a few cats, but I didn't want to follow on with that. And I thought birds are great because they're always just flying around, you know, they're free, and imagine having that, you know.
And we are obsessed with them as a nation, so.
Exactly.
Mm.
So I've been collecting these bird books and cutting out bird pictures and incorporating them as sort of abstract shapes within the composition. Yeah, so if I put one on a table, it becomes a sculpture. If I put one in the foreground of a domestic environment, is that a pet? Or it could be anything, you know?
I wanted to talk about some technical aspects. So you have settled on acrylics, right? So why acrylics over oil? Is that preference of paint?
It's a completely different medium. When I was about 2010, 2011, I was exclusively using oil paint up until then. And I wanted the work to become more and more detailed. And oil paint was a really tricky medium for me because I've always felt like oil painting was like smearing peanut butter on toast. I always painted too thick, too quickly, and I wanted to have a smoother surface. And it was around the time that I started wanting to create these pseudo-anatomical paintings as well.
Mm.
And also, I painted in my apartment at the time. And I remember Caitlin, I used to have about 10 wet oil paintings lying around and all over the place. People would walk into them. They were problematic. They would take 3 or 4 weeks to dry. And I thought I would just give it a go and try the acrylic. And I
So the oil was, though, problematic in the sense of like almost health concerns for you and partner?
I didn't like the chemicals.
Yeah.
I didn't like the drying time. And the way I wanted to test out ideas wasn't easy with oil paint. Everything took too long. I had to wait for a long time just to one thing to dry so I could overpaint it.
Yeah, so back to that point or point around pointillism, like there is so many marks that go into your work, right? So I wondered if that was going to be the answer around oil. I just imagine it would drive you nuts waiting for things to dry.
Yeah, and it was just really practical. When I changed to acrylic, it just, everything seemed a lot easier for some reason. And there's a lot of romanticism around oil painting in that. And I thought, actually, it doesn't need to be like that. I can do what I want with acrylic and still have that. I mean, Bill Hammond didn't use oil paint. I don't even think Colin McCann used oil paint all that much in the later years. I think he used a lot of acrylics. So I thought, well, give it a go. And it worked out really well. And it's this beautiful anatomical painting of this profile of a head, and it was called Network. It was the first one that I made, and I
first acrylic work.
Yeah, and it was great because I thought, okay, I'll just do the outline of a head, and I thought, okay, I'll just do a blob where the eye is and a blob where the nose is and a blob where the brain is, and then I'm free to do whatever I want in that. People will read that as an anatomical painting even though it's not real. I mean, a doctor wouldn't look at it and go, oh, that doesn't make sense. It doesn't matter. It created a freedom for me to explore paint and express myself with mediums and stuff like that to create a painting.
Because colour is really important to your work. Again, going back to that, the way you use colour to contrast and create that kaleidoscopic or psychedelic experience for the viewer with paint. With acrylics, I'm assuming you're not mixing colour straight out of the tube.
No, I'm definitely mixing a lot of colour.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. Oh, the world of colour mixing is a big one. Yeah. I don't even want to start that conversation right now.
I want you to.
Well, colour is a fascinating world. I mean, Rob McLeod is definitely an influence of colour. I mean, he uses a lot of colour.
Mm.
And so I've always been interested in colour. It's a great, great subject. I mean, there's endless options, and it's a really difficult one, I think. And I spent a lot of years learning how to use colour. And I feel like I've only really, just in the last couple of years, really starting to get the hang of colour.
Yeah, so what were those lessons, you know, those hard yards over the years learning colour? Like, what were some of the key lessons for you, especially in the context, obviously, of how you use them and how you use colour?
Well, again, there's no right or wrong combination of colour. It's just how you pair them together and for what reason and what does that do to the subject matter within the painting, and that push-pull kind of, because you can really throw people off if you put things in an awkward way on a canvas, you know. If you create something that's too optical, people won't be able to look at it for too long. And well, that can be interesting too if you're trying to repel people's visual kind of thing. But for me, I want people to come into the work and slow down a little bit.
Mm.
But yeah, I really like colour mixing. I had to sort of teach myself how to colour mix. I didn't have someone sit me down. Like, Rob didn't teach me how to mix colour or anything like that. I sort of sat down myself and just learned it over the years by making lots and lots of paintings, really. But now I'm really conscious of colour, really conscious, and I'm really thinking about how colour can influence reading of a work and the meaning of a work and activate spaces and Yeah.
It feels like actually you've ended up, you know, muting colours a little bit, I suppose, especially in terms of the larger sections of paintings now. Is that fair? Or?
Yeah, I think it's because it activates the bigger colours.
Hmm.
And in the past, I would have just thrown big colours, bright colours, all at once at a canvas where, and that's great. But now I'm like, okay, well, what if I use all these muted colours like your Naples and the grey, these softer colours to elevate the brighter colours like pinks and oranges and...
Oh, and gold leaf, right?
Gold, yeah, gold colour, not real gold.
Yeah, right. Oh, yes, gold leaf is real gold, right?
Yeah, my friend Matt got me onto the gold, Matt Hunt. He suggested, I'll try gold. And I was like, I never used gold before.
Well, it's really working.
I was a bit scared of using it, but now it's sort of like a default colour now at the moment. It's a bit like brown as well. I never used brown until about a year ago because I was always scared of using brown.
Too dull?
I just didn't know how to pair it with contemporary art. It was maybe just the colours that I was using it alongside in the past that didn't work out. And now that I'm using, because I'm painting these, I'm incorporating landscapes and environment rooms, and maybe it's the studio walls of the bare plywood is influencing how I can use it in the painting.
And you prefer painting on linen, I'm assuming Belgian linen?
If I can get Italian linen, I would, but it's very hard to come by in New Zealand. It's very limited. But yes, I use Belgian linen, anything I can get my hands on, really.
And why the preference for linen over, say, canvas or any other support?
Well, cotton canvas doesn't have a sort of a unique weave in it. The linen has a really nice knots and an individual quality to it, which I really like. It's also very durable, so you can do anything you want with it, you know. It's very strong. It's just beautiful stuff to work with.
Mm.
If I do dry brushing over the top of it, you get the weave coming through. But I tend to gravitate towards the smoother linen now. In the past, I would have used a really coarse linen when I was doing thicker, coarser paintings. But now that I'm doing a lot finer work, my work requires finer linen. Especially now I'm trying to control the paint a lot more. Although I probably shouldn't be. I should be working with a looser style. Trying to less control is probably easier than trying to control things too much.
Controlling paint is not a bad segue to next question or questions. The way you apply paint and, again, back to, you know, that pointillism reference, just how small some of the marks are that you make, there must be quite a broad range of tools that you're using.
That's right, yeah, and it's part of the language of the painting too. I think that's how people recognise my work now, is I have a sort of a language which I adopt, I guess a textural language I adopt on the painting, but it's always changing. You know, every work that I make, I try to bring in a new thing and take out an old thing, so it's an ever-evolving practice. But yes, I use brushes usually in the underpainting to create the sort of backdrop. And then I use sticks to create the blobby textures on top.
Sticks found in the garden, sticks?
Sticks, old paintbrushes, which I've taken the heads off. Oh, yeah. Or yes, some sticks from the garden. The reason why I use them is because I've never been good at looking after brushes, and they've always gone hard after a while anyway. And I needed, because I was doing these textural kind of patterns, I needed consistency, and so the sticks were great for that, so they're always the same, and I can just dab them on there, and it didn't matter if I didn't clean them or not. It was just practical reasons.
Yeah, kind of pragmatic approach to mark making.
Yeah, I never liked the idea of buying an expensive brush and then ruining it within the first few months, so I don't buy expensive brushes. My favourite brush at the moment is a 50-cent brush that I stole from one of my daughter's watercolour paint sets.
Right.
It's not to do with the quality of the paintbrushes, it's just the techniques, I guess, you use and adapt over the years.
I was talking to you about this at an opening a while ago, but you also, I was asking about these tiny little, like less than a millimetre, you know, wide, these dots.
Mm.
And you were talking about like using, I think, a lead pencil to...
That's right, a little Bic pencil, click pencil. Again, I use that one because I can sharpen the end if I want to make really small details, or I can flatten it and round it off. And again, it's just easier to have that consistency of that tool. I use a paint pen as well, which is one of those drawing tools. I use a lot of liquid paint, so it's just easier to work with those sort of tools. And I use a palette knife as well for underpainting. I'm trying to incorporate overpainting as well. I'm trying to think about how I can use more gestural overpainting over the top of my detailed mark making at the moment. So incorporating small gestures within.
What with the name of, like, at least from your experience, loosening up what the painting looks like?
Yeah, trying to create a variety of surfaces within the painting. Rather than having a uniform surface, trying to see how I can pair up a gestural mark with a really controlled pattern, I guess. Yeah. Mm,
right, so again, create contrast.
Hmm.
I think final question. So removing, you know, all limits of, you know, scale, budget, etc., one artist or work that you'd love to live with or, you know, experience every day?
Would have to be Hieronymus Bosch, The Garden of Delights.
Hmm.
It's a fascinating painting. It's a three-panelled work. And little is known about that painting. It was painted in sort of between 1480 and 1500, you know. And it's a great three-panel work. I think my Heaven and Hell or, you know, it's just beautifully detailed. Must have taken him 15 years to paint. I guess if you're going to live with one painting, it's got to have a lot going on. But I couldn't live with just one painting, so I'd have to say the Rodin Gates to Hell as well, the sculpture. Imagine having that in your garden.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Good Oil. Your next opportunity to see new work from Ari is at Sweet Gallery in Auckland in his show Breathing Room between the 2nd of August and the 26th of August. Or contact Sweet Gallery in Auckland and Wellington for available works. Thanks again for listening. Note The Good Oil will take a short break from the usual release schedule, returning with the next episode on the 20th of August. Please join me for that. Until then, ka kite anō.